So if you are not in perfect bliss and fully liberated, it's not because of the environment. I think in this world it doesn't actually get too much better than this. So if this is not enough to get you there all the way, then you know that there's some internal work that needs to be done here. And of course, that's what we're here for. So, I was going to talk a little about Donna. I forgot about that. I meant to do that earlier. So let me go back and pick that piece up, and then we'll go in and talk about the meditation. Donna, as many of you know, is part of the economics about how all this system works. And when I was in Thailand, you could see how the whole thing evolved. I would go into a wat there. Wat is a cross between a sort of monastery and community center. It's what they do in Thailand. And they would give me room. They would feed me as a novice meditator in their eyes. I was supposed to wear white clothes, so they would give me white clothes. They'd take me a doctor if I needed it. They just took care of you. And then the surrounding community just took care of the wat. It was this, and it was all just done on this system of generosity. And you can see the kids from a very young age sort of learn to put rice, you know, in the bowls of the monks who are going around their alms rounds. And there's all this sort of delight, you know, in this giving and the sharing and giving and sharing. And then when we try to bring this system to America, well, you know, in a consumption-oriented society, there's the unspoken rule is that if you can get the most by paying the least, that's the best system for you. When people brought this Donna system to the United States, it presents this whole the cognitive dissonance, a sort of strain about to figure out what to do with this. And so typically, as I've always done in my teaching, because I just love the Donna system, and say, you know, you can give whatever you're most comfortable giving. There was this internet cafe in one of the wats in Thailand that had this sign on the front of it that said, free internet, donations accepted as you are comfortable. And that was sort of the rules, looking for a place that, you know, that you're comfortable. But it's all with a very different cultural background to it. So what happens, in this country, when you don't put a price on something, is people tend to think, well, it's probably not worth very much. Right? And even if we don't believe in that whole system, it's so deeply ingrained here. I'm putting together a little nonprofit organization. It's called Easing Awake to support all this. And the first thing that my new board wanted to do was actually take on the issue of Donna. And they wrote this little booklet. There's just a little tiny thing over there that you can take if you like. Because they said it's really confusing for people how to work with this. So somewhat on their pushing, I went out and I spent some looking around to try to figure out what these retreats are worth on the spiritual marketplace. And the room and board here is about average, and maybe a little bit lower. We're getting a pretty good deal here, actually, particularly for California. And for the Donna that people give, because I don't receive any of the registration money. That all just all goes to pay for the for the room and board and a little bit of administrative overhead. And so the Donna at the end is stuff that's given to me so I can pay for car and mortgage and medical expenses and, I mean, all the things that that you have. When I left the church a couple of years ago, I wanted to see what it would be like if I could just live on Donna. It's been an experiment for me. And so at the end of the retreat, there'll be a chance to offer to that. And when I look around on the spiritual marketplace, retreats like this are worth probably somewhere in the range of $50 to $100 a day. And if you can't afford that, that's fine. It really is fine. Part of the reason I put together this nonprofit is a commitment. I never want to turn anybody away because of money. And some people are living a very restricted amount of money. But I want you to know what the value of it is, and that whatever you can give is really very much appreciated and very welcomed. Years ago, I had a couple came to me when I was serving as a minister. They wanted to get married, and so we had talked about what they wanted for the ceremony, and I told them what the usual ministerial fee was, and I told them if you couldn't afford it, that's fine, we'll talk about it. And so the next time we met, when we got back together, I think I was asking maybe $250. That was back a long time ago. And they came back and they said, well, we want to pay you $75. And I said, okay, so why is that? And they said, well, because we think that's what it's worth. And I said to them, there is a congregational minister down the street who's really a good guy. And I know he would do it for $75. And they said, wait a minute, I thought you said we could talk about it. And I said, no, that's not what I meant. I said, if you couldn't afford it, but if you don't think it's worth it, I know what I put into this, and if it's not worth it to you, you can get it somewhere else, and it's just fine. If you can't afford it, that's different. So this was the guy that was talking, and so his wife-to-be pulled him aside, and they quick came back, and I think I ended up doing it for $75. They were, young couple, and they probably didn't have much money, and he was just kind of blustering how he talked about it. But that's the distinction, for me. I put a lot into this, and I know what it takes to keep me going. And if you can't afford that, that's really fine. But I want you to know all that. And behind all of that, what the Dana is really about is that it's really the core of what this practice is. It's about joy and freedom. There's in that little booklet, there's a little story at the front of it. Some of you may have heard it, of this guy who had this pair of gloves. I think it's a true story, although it sounds like an urban legend. But just pretend it's a true story because I really love it. He had this pair of gloves that he was very fond of. He was getting on the subway one day, and he looked out, and there was a glove. He was inside the subway looking out on the platform. There was a glove there that looked just like his. He looked down, and sure enough, he dropped one of those. And the doors to the subway were closing at that point. So he didn't have enough time to get out there. So he took the one glove he had and threw it out there to be with the other one. So, because one glove wasn't going to serve him, so whoever who found out would at least have a nice pair for himself. So what I think about generosity, if you think about what that impulse was in that guy, that's what the generosity really is about. There is something that is deeply, deeply, profoundly human that just wants to be of help to other people. And you can see in some of the Asian cultures where that generosity is alive, how that really is out there on the surface. In this culture, we tend to teach something else. He who gets the most toys wins, or something like that. But it denies the real spirit, and actually the sense of freedom that comes from that. Are we just reading a Dhamma talk last night where somebody mentioned that Ajahn Sumedho, are you familiar Ajahn Sumedho? He was in England for a while. He went back to sort of retired back into the hills of Thailand somewhere. And he used to say, every time I think about myself, I get depressed. And part of the generosity is actually the freedom from that selfing. You know, is that sense of really reaching out, you know, beyond ourselves. And that we really are not happy, deeply happy, when we're just focused on here. It's not enough for how we're designed. So we'll be talking more about this and how it relates to the practice as the week goes on. But I just wanted to give you that that frame of reference. We're not going to be there won't even be an opportunity to give any dana until the end of the retreat. But I didn't want to spring this whole thing on people on the last day. So you can just let that percolate in the back. And know that from my perspective that whatever you offer is really deeply appreciated. And I know that our hearts are infinite. But money is always finite. You know, and so we have to figure out how to manage all of this stuff. If you give more than what is really balanced for you, there's a place that'll resent it. You know, and that kind of gets in the way of the practice. And if you give less than what's right for you, there's a place in you to think you're getting away with something. You know, and so that'll disrupt it too. So really consider that just part of the practice to find where that balance point is. And it's an ongoing practice. We don't get it right. We don't get the meditation right either, but we're just constantly, you know, sort of learning from it and tuning it to get it more right and more in balance. Okay. I think that's all I have to say about dana. Do you have any questions or thoughts? D-A-N-A, with a long line over the first A. There's this little sangha that invites me to come to talk 3 or 4 or 5 times a year, and the woman who organizes it, his name is Donna. So this is for me. Yes. Okay. So what are we all about here? What's the practice all about? Do any of you know Jim Scott? Jim Scott is he's a world-class musician. He's an acoustical guitarist. He used to play with a Paul Winter consort. And he's a composer. He's recorded 4 or 5 or 6 albums on his own. And he was out touring here in California a couple of years ago. And so I set up a concert for him on Sunday afternoon in Sacramento when he was passing through there. And before the concert started, Jim and I were on stage just making sure the stage was right and get the microphone, the equipment right. And as we were doing all that stuff, he got to talking about his life. Some of his personal struggles. He was really very open about it all. Some of his concerns about his family, some anguish. Emotions came to the surface very easily. There were tears coming out of his eyes. And after a few minutes, I interrupted him and I said, Jim, there are about 200 people out there that are watching us, and the concert was supposed to start about 5 minutes ago. And he said, oh. And so he turned on the mic and picked up his guitar and sat down and delivered for 2 hours this just exquisite concert in which he was totally present and totally attuned. The audience was there. The music just seemed to flow through him from somewhere beyond. And I remember wondering, was this what it was like to be around Mozart? You know, Mozart reportedly, his personal life was really messed up. It was just really all torn apart. But when he composed or played music, it's like he just got out of the way. And this beauty would flow through him. And that's what gems seem to do. It was really remarkable. The lyrics to the lead song on one of his album, it's a song called There's a Way. I just want to read the lyrics to you. I'd love to sing it and play it because he does it so beautifully, but that would be too painful given my level of skill. I would just as soon let some days go by without worrying about things I hadn't done. I would just as soon let some time go by without worrying about battles never won. I would just as soon let a woman or a man live at peace on the land. And before we would judge the way they live their lives, we'd be prepared to lend a hand. There's a way, and there's an ease to this life we live. There's a dream of peace not so far away. There's a force and a flow to the life we lead if we would just release and let it be that way. I would just as soon let all wounds heal in time without worrying about who deserves the blame. I would just assume there'd be no heroes in war, though you win, you lose, it all works out the same. I would prefer we'd find a compromise so nobody dies in a senseless fight over how to divide the earth or sea or skies. There's a way and there's an ease to this life we lead. There's a dream of peace not so far away. There's a force and a flow to this life we lead if we would just release and let it be that way. I would just as soon passing fashion's delight without binding us to all in life that's vain. I would just as soon that passions be for love and not dominance and war for selfish gain. It would be enough for me, the fleeting beauty of the wild, that I might be beguiled, without boundaries, without lies, that I could see with the eyes and the wisdom of a child. There is a way and there is an ease to this life we lead. There's a dream of peace, not so far away. There's a force and there's a flow to this life we lead if we will just release and let it be that way. So we're gathered here this evening to begin this retreat. And as we do so, all of us bring in a certain amount of struggles or concerns, poignancies, maybe anguish. There's stuff that comes in from our lives. And in this retreat, we're not going to try to fix any of that. During the next 9 days, we're not going to be analyzing that stuff or sorting it out or try to figure out what to do about it. Our intent here on this retreat is actually much more radical than that. We're going to start and we're going to work from the proposition that there's nothing that has to be fixed. There's a love, there's a kindness, there's a wisdom, there's a clarity that can flow through all of us. And when it does, if there's something that needs fixed, that'll take care of it. We don't have to do it. There's a way and there's an ease to the life we lead. There's a dream of peace not so far away, not so far away. There's a force and there's a flow to the life we lead if we will just release and let it be that way. So, the trick is to release it and get out of the way. Easy to say, it's not so easy to do. So for help in figuring how to do this, we're going to turn to another artist, a spiritual artist, by the name of Siddhartha Gautama of the Sakya clan. 2,500 years ago, left very pointed, very detailed instructions about how to get out of the way, step by step, almost paint by the number instructions about how to get out of the way. The essence of what the Buddha said is a paradox. To get out of the way, we don't turn away from anything. To get out of the way, we turn towards it. Whatever disturbances come up in our lives, we turn towards it and relax into it. Turning towards it and relaxing into it. That's what our job is here, basically, on this retreat. To figure out how to do that wisely and skillfully. Here's another image for turning towards. I spent the first 16 years of my life, I grew up in Houston, Texas. And on summer days, my mother would take the five of us kids, would drive us the 60 miles down to Galveston so we could swim in the Gulf of Mexico. And I don't know if any of you have ever been in southern Texas, but it is just about as flat can be. Houston is 60 miles from Galveston, and it is 60 feet above sea level. So that's what the slant of the land is. It's about 1 foot per mile. So the Gulf of Mexico is like that, too. So when we were swimming in the Gulf, you know, we would wade out, and you could go out 150 or 200 feet and still only be up to your waist. So we get out there, and a wave comes in. Well, so the first thing you want to do is run from the wave, but, you know, when you're up the water to your waist, it's really exhausting to try to run through the water, and it's a long way to go, and if you try to run from it, it's just going to knock you flat. So the first thing we learned to do was actually to brace ourselves. So the waves came in, they said, you know, plant your feet in there and let the wave crash on you. And that would work for small waves. But for big waves, you know, we just weren't strong enough. So for big waves, gradually we learned the only thing to do was to relax into them, and the really big ones to relax and to dive into them at the same time. It was the only way you could deal with them. So the Buddha's first truth, first ennobling truth, first of the four truths, is, as many of you know, it's called dukkha, it's a Pali word for it, which means suffering happens, basically what it means. Circumstances change, relationships shift, people we know die, things break, everything falls apart sooner or later, we all die. He didn't say, the Buddha never said that life is suffering, but what he said was that suffering is an inherent part of life. Anybody here never suffered? That's all he was saying. It's really kind of obvious. So what he was saying was life sends us waves. The waves of delight, waves of pain, waves of freedom, waves of anxiety, waves of peace, waves of disturbance. Sometimes we come on a retreat because we're trying to get away from the painful waves. Right? We're just trying to get a little few moments of peace or a stretch of peace. But ultimately, running from the waves is futile. If we do, they'll just catch up with us, catch us from behind and knock us over. Some people say Buddhism is a religion. Some say it's a philosophy. Some say it's a code of practice, spiritual practices, and it's all of those. But at its core, think the essence of what the Buddha taught is just an attitude towards life. It's this attitude of turning towards and relaxing into. And if we do that, gradually what we begin to learn is that as scary and as frothy as the waves may seem when they're coming towards us, if we relax and just dive into them, what happens is the surf passes over really quickly, and then we're left in the essence of the wave, which is water. Not so bad. Not so bad. And then we actually come up in this little valley, peaceful valley between the waves. And in time, we may learn how to rest in the waves themselves. So, if you came into this retreat with an idea that somehow the meditation is going to protect you from the slings and arrows of misfortune, my condolences. I'm sorry for your loss. As far as I've been able to discover, there's really nothing. There's nothing that can protect us from the ocean of life. I mean, it's where we live. It's where we live. But what the meditation can do is it can give us this way of relaxing and releasing into it. What it can do for us is give us a healthy, wholesome, an ultimately freeing way to respond so that we don't tumble about quite so much. I did a little bit of training with the Korean Zen master Sansein, and he had this statue of a Buddha. I brought four little ones here. But he had this wooden statue of a Buddha that must have been, I don't know, 12, 16 inches tall. And the bottom of it, though, was carved round. And he had a piece of elastic that he'd stapled to the bottom of it. And the other end of the elastic he stapled to this board that this whole Buddha sat on. And so he'd be talking. This actually was usually on this side. And every once in a while he would just swing his hand at it. And it would whap this Buddha with the back of his hand. And it would go flatten out. And then the elastic would pull it back up. You know, bong. And I used to say, nothing can protect us from being hit by life, you know, from time to time. But he said, hopefully meditation will give you, is the rubber band that'll pull you back, will give you some resilience. So that's what we're looking for here, is some resilience. So in this retreat, we're not going to be trying to escape anything. You may try for a while. Good luck. When we try to get away from stuff, we just end up struggling with it a lot longer. But hopefully, this will help strengthen your resilience. So we'll be talking more about this in detail as the week goes on. But for tonight, I know a lot of you are tired. It takes a lot to get here. So what I'd like to do is, with just that kind of overview, is to shift gears and to just talk about the practice itself. Just go into the details of it. And by the way, I know from years of talking that when I'm talking about stuff like this that feels very intimate to me, sometimes my voice will get very soft. And so if I disappear on you, put your hand up to your ear or something like that to signal me. If you do that, my voice goes up. I don't have to do it. If I just know somebody's having trouble hearing, my voice goes up. So if you can't hear me, it's your own fault. But please turn my volume up. So there are two practices that work very closely with each other, that we'll be working with here. And as you learn these practices, they unfold and they evolve and they go deeper. So for those of you who have been working with this practice for a while, if you've moved to a different place with it, feel free to just continue from where you are. But for those who are new, and actually for all of you who have been doing this for a while, I think it's really helpful to go back through the bedrock of these two practices. They're really the, I don't know what they call it on highways, but when they build a highway, there's layers and layers, and there's some bedrock underneath it. Well, this is really the bedrock of the whole path. So, first thing you want to do before you start meditating is find a relatively comfortable place to sit. And as Jordan was saying, the grounds around here, there are lots of places. Probably not a good idea to sit out in the direct sun for obvious reasons, but if you want to sit outside, that's fine. This room here is going to be reserved for meditation, for sitting meditation, so you're welcome to sit here. Have a walking meditation elsewhere. If you want to do some stretching or yoga, there's lots of other spaces around here. But this room we're going to preserve for meditation, so this will be a relatively quiet place. In the text, it's called finding a secluded place, and this just means a protected, quiet place. And then you want to sit some way that's comfortable for you. If you lounge or you lay down, we are deeply conditioned to go to sleep. And so when you lay down, the mind just says, ah, time to go to sleep. So there are some people that have trouble with their back or other reasons where they really have to lie down. So there's no avoiding it, but it's usually easier if you can sit up to sit up. But you don't have to sit up stiffly. It's helpful to sit in a relatively erect posture, but make sure it's relaxed and comfortable. You don't have to sit cross-legged. I did for years. I loved it. But I think in the Buddha's time, there were very few chairs around. They were mostly for rulers, etc. Everybody sat on the floor. So when he said sit cross-legged, he was just saying sit how you usually sit. So find some way of sitting that's comfortable for you. Your body will give you distractions sooner or later. If you just sit without moving for several hours, the body starts to hurt. So you'll deal with that at some point. But it's important in the beginning to find ways that you can not have to deal with that until there's more stability. So you get a quiet place, sit in a way that's comfortable, and then when you actually sit down to practice, remember some time when you were happy. Happiness comes in all kinds of flavors. It may have been that you just accomplished something and you feel really great about it. Or there can be a sort of different kind of happiness that's the sort of thing that when you hold a small animal and it kind of cuddles in with you, there's kind of a softness. There's another kind of happiness, which is sort of a joy of watching children play. It's another kind of happiness, which is sort of the serenity. Sitting by an ocean at sunset. The flavor of the happiness is not important. All of us have felt love, all of us have felt kindness, all of us have felt ease. So when you sit down to practice, just remember what that felt like. Okay. And so you allow that feeling to come up, and then you put yourself right in the center of it. It feels like sometimes like a glowing in the center of your chest. And you just put yourself, imagine yourself right in the middle of that. Some people visualize very easily, and it's very easy to picture that. Other people don't visualize easily. That's fine. Just have that sense of whole and you in this kind space. And then we use these little phrases, ways of sending well-wishing to yourself. May I be happy. May I be peaceful. May I have ease and well-being as I go through my day. You just take that wish and you send it to yourself. You surround that yourself with that as you're holding yourself in your heart. The phrases I think of as priming the pump. They're a way of just kind of starting the feeling going. And as soon as the feeling comes up, then you just put your attention on the feeling itself, not so much on the phrases. Okay. Sooner or later, the feeling's going to fade, and then you say another phrase. Okay. What you don't want to do is say the phrases mechanically. The sincerity of the wish is important. So as you do this, there will be three things going on there that you could attend to. One is the phrase. The second is the person that you're sending it to, which in the beginning I've talked about now is just yourself. And the third is the feeling itself. You want about three quarters, most the bulk of your awareness on the feeling itself, because it is the feeling itself that will evolve and open and eventually go all the way into nibbana. So it's the feeling itself. I'll talk about spiritual friend in a moment, as another person will be sending it to. The phrase itself, you probably never want more than about 5% of your attention on it. It's just a very light thing, so it's not done like people do mantras or affirmations. It's very light. Okay, so when you sit down and meditate, you're sending kindness, well-being, any uplifted qualities find yourself for about 10 minutes. And then after 10 minutes, you shift to what we're going to call a spiritual friend for the remainder of the sitting and send it to them. A spiritual friend is somebody who's living, who you find it very easy to wish them the best. It might be a teacher you had who really kind of got who you were, you know, and it might be a friend who always seems to have your back. Might be, sometimes it might be a small child that just opens your heart. If you are in a partnered relationship, your partner is probably not a good choice for a spiritual friend. Right. For obvious reasons. There may be a whole lot of love there, but those relationships tend to be complicated. And so for the purpose of meditation, we want this simple. For the same reasons, you probably would not, if you have a teenage child, they would probably not be a good spiritual friend, because those the texture of those relationships can be quite involved, or a grandchild or a nephew or somebody like that. So you want to keep this real simple. It also... it's best to not be somebody who you might be physically attracted to. Physical attraction can be quite lovely, but it has, you know, a certain kind of density of its own. We want to keep this sort of light and easy. So for the remainder of the sitting, you'll be sending it to a spiritual friend. Does everybody have somebody that comes to mind? Either you've been doing this before, or somebody comes to mind. Anybody have a trouble? Okay. So when you're starting with this, I want you to stick with that person for the duration. Sometimes people are tempted to switch to another person. It's actually not about the person at all. this whole thing is about you and your practice and somebody that evokes this. So if you stick with the same person, it will go deeper and open up and softer and keep opening. If you switch around from person to person, it doesn't work as efficiently. And don't worry about it, that as this practice gets stronger, the other people in your life are going to benefit from it as well, even if they're not the explicit focus. There's something about just getting this all this flowing that they will benefit from it. So again, each time you sit down, you send, I'm just going to call it metta for now, but metta covers this whole, I'm using the term to cover a whole range of any uplifted state for about 10 minutes, and for remainder of the sitting, then you send it to your spiritual friend. So does anybody have any questions about that part? How's your energy holding up? Are you all ready for bed? Okay, I'll try to go through the rest of this quickly. And feel free to interrupt me at any point. One of the advantages of having a relatively small group is that it's easier to actually have your input in. So please feel free to interrupt me at any time. So you're sitting there and you're sending kindness, well-being, compassion, joy, these qualities, and it's going along lovely, and then the next thing you know is you're thinking about your boss and that remark that you made the other day, or, you know, you're thinking about, now, when am I supposed to get up tomorrow, and what's the time, you know, our grocery list, all kinds of things come in. Mind has a mind of its own. We are descendants from scavengers, you know, evolutionary terms. The way that scavengers survive is actually to explore and think about and actually work out what's going on in the environment so they can find their food, because they're not wired in to just go kill the same animal. So we have these minds that want to go out and explore and figure things out. So your mind will do that. It'll go out and start thinking about all kinds of things. And what I would say is that if you are sitting there and you are sending loving kindness to yourself or your spiritual friend or peace or ease, and you notice all these thoughts coming up around the sides, they're coming in, and you're still aware of the kindness or the ease, just ignore those stray thoughts. Don't push them away. Just ignore them. Let them play in the wings. You know, they can play around in the background, do whatever they want. As long as you're aware of the kindness, you just stay with that. But sooner or later, they will disappear, and you won't even know it when they disappeared. You'll just be gone, off thinking about that novel you're reading or perfecting your arguments or whatever it is. And then a little bit of wisdom will spontaneously come into your system. And that wisdom will be in the form of a thought, which is, oh, I was meditating. Right? A little bit of awareness comes in, and suddenly you see, okay, that you are gone. What you do at that point has more effect, either positive or negative, on the meditation than anything else. Left to our own devices, without any instruction, what most people will do is say, oops, I'm doing the wrong thing, and they quick, you know, bring their awareness back to their spiritual friend, get back to kindness quickly as I can. And that's actually a form of greed. You're trying to get, you don't like where you are, trying to get someplace, you're grasping for it. But we all do it at times. So what we do here instead is we have this process that some of, maybe many of you are familiar with, but we affectionately call it the six R's. I have a little cheat sheet for the six R's. If you already know these well, somebody wake Susan up here. if you need it, here's a little cheat sheet that's got your six R's on it. So I would say that, as I was saying before, there are these two practices. One is the sending of loving kindness, and the other is the six R's. And the only place you can use the six R's is when your attention has been totally hijacked. And it is an incredibly powerful, enormously useful practice. So when your attention gets hijacked, you can celebrate that. It's great. You get a chance to use this. That may sound overblown, but the first retreat I did after I had learned this, I got so much mileage out of 6R in my distracting thoughts that I got to the point in the retreat for a bunch of days when I was just sitting there waiting for something to distract me so I could use it. But of course, you know what happens as soon as you actually turn towards something and say, okay, you know, come on, I'm ready. It wouldn't show up. But you have a chance to use this when your awareness gets completely hijacked. And so these are six actions which are related, which eventually become one action. They're related to six energies, which become one energy, and they're actually related to the six qualities of mind that eventually becomes unified. So it's it works on many, many different levels, and we'll unpack all that in the coming nights. But right now, I just want to run through the mechanics of it. So you're sitting there, and a thought comes up, oops, I was supposed to be meditating. And so the first thing you want to do is just to recognize where your attention has gone. Just to recognize that you've been distracted. You don't have to get into the thought, to the content of a thought. Right? Actually, it's best not to get into the content of a thought. The content of our thoughts would free us. We'd be living in a different world. So we've gotten all the mileage out of that. But you notice, oh, I'm thinking or I'm arguing. I'm distracted. My attention is off on somewhere else. That's a recognize step. Then the next thing you do is you release it. Those of you who know me, I always love to quote Suzuki Roshi, the best way to control a cow is to put it in a very large pasture. That's what the release step is. It's just to let it be. You know, and the distraction may run off over the field and disappear. It may come back and, you know, look in your eyes. You don't care. You're just not holding on to it or pushing it away. You recognize, release. And then the third R is the most important one. It's the thing that distinguishes the Buddha's practice from everything else that was around him at the time. The third step is to relax. Relax the mind, relax the emotions, relax the body. Anytime your attention goes away, there will be some tension that has grabbed your awareness and pulled it away. So it's very, very important to relax. Sometimes you won't even see what the tension is. Sometimes it'll be too subtle. That's okay. It's an invitation to relax. It's kind of like saying, okay, you know, system, you can let down now if you want. It's an invitation. Recognize, release, relax. And then the fourth one is to bring in some uplifted states, which, if you're feeling grumpy, can be really hard to do. But the one thing you can always do is to smile. Right? Just physically raise the corners of your mouth a little bit. And what we know from brain physiology, when you do that, it actually lightens the mind a little bit. So we call it re-smile because we needed an R. Recognize, release, relax, re-smile. And at that point, then you go back to sending out loving kindness to yourself and your spiritual friend. Because at that point, you've recognized what's going on, you've released it, you've released the tension in yourself, you've brought up some more uplifted states. So then rather than bringing the sort of dense mind that was caught up in a distraction, you're bringing back a more uplifted state, a quieter, more open state. And as the mind quiets, it becomes quite, quite sensitive. So all this relaxing and releasing actually increases mindfulness. the most effective way I know to cultivate mindfulness. And it's also an embodied way of practicing what the Buddha called wise effort. Okay, recognize, release, relax, re-smile, return. And then we threw on the end this the sixth one, which is repeat, which will happen all by itself when the next distraction comes up. So you actually don't do that with a five. It will come along. But it's there as a reminder that you may be doing this a lot. You may be doing this a whole lot. If you want a really sort of nitty-gritty definition of what meditation is, what I would call it is remembering to recognize, remembering to see the movements of the mind's attention. Okay. So if your mind is drawn off 1,000 times, you know, during a space of 45 minutes, and you 6R it 1,000 times, that's actually very, very good practice. There are other styles of meditation, they're called shamatha, styles of meditation that try to induce deeply ecstatic states by getting you to focus on one item and one item alone, so you just... And when you focus down there, it pushes away all the hindrances, all the distractions, and it can get quite elevated and can get quite ecstatic. The only problem with it is it's a dead end. It's a long story, but for those of you who know the story of the Buddha's, his own enlightenment and liberation, is that he mastered all those one-pointed concentration practices that were available at his time completely. And he would come out of those states and say, well, there's still the seeds of greed, hatred, and delusion in me. It doesn't work. And so when he sat down under the Bodhi tree, he was doing a very different kind of practice, which was one of just learning to see how the mind actually operates and to turn towards it and relax into it. And what he discovered was that if you can see clearly how the mind, heart operate, that's enough to free you. So in this practice, we're not trying to control the mind. We're trying to see how the mind's attention moves. And the six R's are an enormously helpful way to do that, to see that, to see how they work. I think I've gone on long enough. Questions? Concerns?
Beginning and ending of meditation, it's an ambiguous amount of time.
Yes. So what I would say is that for sitting, if you're actually starting... So minimum of 30 minutes, 45 minutes is probably good. And if you're comfortable to sit longer, okay.
And then walk.
And then shift into a walking meditation. And in the walking meditation, it's actually the same practice. So I'd encourage you to walk at a fairly normal pace.
So we'll have to have our own watch to keep track of.
There will be bells. So what's going to happen is that there will be these periods of time in the morning, and then in the afternoon there's a chunk of time for sitting and walking meditation. And if you've been to, as I've spent a lot of time at places like Insight Meditation Society and Spirit Rock, where they have, where they're all timed, you know, everybody sits for 45 minutes and they walk for certain and come back and forth. What happens with that is at its best, is that the timing of those is based on what I think is wisest. But all of us are different. You know, there will be some of you who will actually need you know, and want and feel drawn to sit for long periods of time. There may be other times where you want to sit for shorter amounts of time. And so part of this practice is actually cultivating wisdom, seeing the movements of the mind, heart, and recognizing when it's actually better for you to sit and when it's better for you to walk. And so you'll experiment with this, and I mean, we all do, and to actually fine-tune that so that you actually learn what works best for you.
So we just go back and forth between those two until the bell rings and it's
right.
Time to stop meditating.
Yeah. Or time to move into an eating meditation or, awareness. So to expand out on that a little bit, the awakening factor, one of the most powerful ones, is mindfulness. And the best way to cultivate mindfulness is to keep it going continuously. And if you try too hard to keep it going continuously, you'll tire and stop. It'll wear out. So there will be these formal times for sitting and walking meditation, and they'll be eating and moving around and other things. And to lightly just be aware of what's going on inside you as much as you possibly can, without pushing it. Without pushing it. What happens to mindfulness is that as it grows stronger, it starts to develop some of its own momentum. You know, at first it needs to be kind of supported a little bit, but as it gets stronger, it develops its own momentum. For those of you who have been on retreats, you know, before, you may have had this experience of leaving and say, oh, okay, I can stop being mindful. Well, you can't turn it off. You know, you develop some momentum. So, and I think what happens with, quite frankly, with awakening and liberation is that the mindfulness gets so powerful, it just won't turn off. It just won't. It just keeps going. So we work towards that and, you know, and be gentle. So, does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
The block of time is, how long is that in the morning?
So there'll be breakfast at 7. And then I think on the schedule it says 9 o'clock, but any time after that you feel like starting sitting and walking, that's fine. After lunch, I actually encourage people to rest, you know, for about an hour. And maybe fall asleep or maybe just lie down and rest. But I think that's helpful. Meditation actually requires a lot of energy. And particularly as the practice goes deeper, you know, when your body is tired, we give lip surface service to a nama rupa, mind, body, you know, they work together. But you'll just see it as it gets, you know, as the mind gets quieter, if you are tired, the mind will just be scattered. It requires energy. So, if you are somebody that tends to sleep too much, then you may want to back on off in a little bit. But in my experience, for everybody who sleeps too much, there are, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 people who don't quite get enough sleep. So what I, quite frankly, have always done on retreats is the first couple of days, you know, when I get tired, I just go lie down.
From 5:30 to 7, we're going to be chanting?
No. So there is a tea time. Is that at 5:30?
In the evening at 5:30, tea intervals.
In the morning.
So in the morning, we'll start off tomorrow. Tomorrow I'll talk a little bit about the refuges and the precepts. Not a lot.
We'll do the
refuges and the precepts and aspirations every morning. And then there will be a period from then until 7 for sitting and walking meditation. Well, thanks for asking. You know, I've been doing this so much that it's so ingrained in me, so it's helpful to have somebody say, you know, duh, you left something out, so thank you. Yes. We do that at 6 o'clock. And guess why? Well, it's because it's normally when people are eating. So we won't have an evening meal. There will be plenty of calories and there'll be plenty of food that takes a long time to digest. So I actually love this practice about skipping that meal. But it's a time where we're very conditioned. So it's actually helpful just to have a Dhamma talk at that time to get the mind focused on something else. You don't actually sit and your body stew about that a little bit.
So you're not having the day of the question and answer period because you're meeting with each of us individually.
Right. So tomorrow at 11 we'll have a question and answer period here because the interviews don't start till the next day. And after the Dhamma talk, there will always be, you know, as much time as people want for questions. I can go in all night if you want.
Doug, is a Q&A tomorrow optional?
Q&A tomorrow is optional.
Okay, at 11, Q&A in here optional.
Right.
Okay.
And will someone be saying that, or will it just be a bell?
There will be a bell.
At 11?
Yeah, probably at 5 of 11.
Okay.
Well, in case people are out there.
There will be a bell at 5 to 11.
And we sign up to volunteer to do the bell ringing?
Yes. After we break up here, I'm going to have the yogi volunteer sheet back there, and anybody who would like to be a bell ringer or a tea carrier or a glass, you know, water filler, please come and see me.
And the bell is always kept there on your table?
Yeah. Okay, other questions?
Question about dress. I know Bhante's pretty strict about, like, you know, shorts and stuff. What's your...
I'm a little less strict.
Okay.
The idea there is not to dress in a way that would be distracting, you know, to other people. And so in traditional cultures, you know, they usually want the knees covered and the shoulder covers, etc. I think in America we're around stuff so much that it doesn't need to be as strict. But just be reasonable.
I also want to point out that 5 in the morning the temperature is quite a bit lower than it is in Western America.
Right.
So shorts at 5 in the morning might be a bit breezy.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. That was just an itch on your neck. Yes. Okay. There's a stretch of time now for sitting and walking if you want, or if you had enough and need to go to bed, that's fine too. Use the time well. As we do the precepts in the morning, that will formally put us into silence. So there's a little bit of chatter time without breaking the rules. But you know what to do. Just be wise about it. Okay. So let's just take a moment to come back. We were joking earlier. I don't think it was in a large group, but how? Well, the way I say it is that my wife usually likes me a little bit more when I come back from a meditation, and I like her a little bit more when she comes back from her yoga class. So it's that acknowledgement that when we're doing this practice, it actually benefits the people around us. So whether we formally acknowledge that or not. It's called bodhicitta. It's it just helps, and I think it helps the practice to have this sense that we're doing it not just for own well-being, but whether we know it or not, it's actually helping those around us. And when we help those around us, it helps us in our practice. So I'd like to close in the evening by just being aware of how all that works, of how we are embedded in this sea of relationships, for better or ill. It can affect us either way. We touch not only the people who are close to in our lives, but in fainter and fainter ways, people who are further away. But we're all connected into this network of life. And so knowing that, we spend a few moments as a group, as a sangha, as a gathering, sending out from here to all the beings out there who are close to us and ones further and further away and around the planet and all creatures. May all beings be happy. May all beings know their true nature. May all beings have kindness and ease as they move through their day. May all beings have sweet dreams. May all beings be free. May it be so.